Hey guys, I'm Paul Bates and this is the Fermentation Podcast. Join me on this journey to put fermentation into practice, create culture, and revive this lost art that connects all of us to our cultures of the past. Today is Tuesday, August 12th, 2014, and this is episode number 7. So today I think I got a pretty interesting one for you. I think it's a pretty honest look at veganism. I mean, nothing's more annoying than a newly born evangelical vegan, and I have to admit, in the beginning, I used to be one of those, so I know. But I'd just go into everything about veganism, whether you can be involved in fermentation and be vegan, and then overall, just a lot of the questions that arise when somebody's considering going vegan and the for and the against arguments for either side. And for me, I think it can be extremely healthy, but it can also be extremely unhealthy, and I go into that also. But before I get into that, all the topics and links for today's show will be in the show notes at fermentationpodcast.com. And if you'd like to get a hold of me, email me at paul@fermentationpodcast.com or go to the website and click on the contact button on the top. You can also connect me on Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube, and Twitter. Just go to fermentationpodcast.com and you should see the links in the sidebar. So why did I decide to go vegan? I mean, I get that question in various formats all the time. Probably not as much as I used to because everybody just kind of knows me now, but what were some of the things that actually got me thinking about it? And to start with, there was some health problems, there was some other things that I'll go into later, but me and my wife turned vegetarian in 2004, so it's been about 10 years now. And the first thing that really got me thinking about it was when I went to school for my computer science degree, I took an ethics and technology class. And the teacher was pretty interesting, she was very intense, she was a feminist, which was interesting in itself, even though I don't agree with everything that has to go along with that. But she brought some things to light, you know, I hadn't really asked myself. And there was also a presentation given from PETA and the whole Meet Your Meat video, which if you've grown up and you've never actually seen where your food comes from, you know, it's kind of shocking when you first see what actually goes on. Especially, you know, when PETA portrays it, it's normally some of the worst slaughterhouses and some of the worst factory farms you can imagine. So when you're seeing things like this, it's kind of shocking right off if you've never even considered where does your food come from. And also 10 years ago, the whole mad cow disease was kind of a big issue and a big topic, at least in the vegetarian type of circles. And I think the one thing that kind of hit me was after, you know, learning all about mad cow disease and talking about it in class and, you know, considering it, I think one student raised his hand and asked, so what are you doing about mad cow disease? You know, how are you protecting yourself? And she has said, well, I've been vegetarian for the past 10 years. And, you know, that kind of hit me. It's kind of funny thinking back now, you know, 10 years later, I'm basically in the same area, but I think I have a completely different understanding than, you know, what she did. And along with my ethics and technology class, I also read a really great book that I think everybody should read just to consider what it has to say, and that's Diet for a New America by John Robbins. It has more of like the ethical side of it. He's an amazing author, and I think this book is probably one of the classic books on vegetarianism, and it's well written, and it's probably turned more people vegetarian than I would guess any other book out there. And even if you're not considering going vegetarian or going vegan, it's still a great book to read just to get an idea of what, you know, environmentalists were thinking back in the 80s, you know, some of the arguments and things like that. And up to this point, I would say my diet at the time was pretty bad, at least before this point. I mean, when I look back and I think I used to eat like fried everything. And, you know, it's very bad if you can look back and you can't remember the last time you had a fresh fruit or a fresh vegetable. And, you know, the way me and my brother grew up, it was probably the same way with a lot of kids back then. Because my parents grew up in the age where technology was changing everything. There was canned vegetables, canned fruits, canned everything. And I think they really embraced that. So say for dinner, we would have, you know, dried pasta with canned tomato sauce. They would maybe add a few things to it, but it was mostly canned things, not a whole lot of fresh things, except for, you know, some of the more simple things like fresh bananas and some fresh fruits, but it was mostly canned and packaged and processed things, which I don't fault them for. It was just, you know, the way they also grew up too. So they were just passing on what they knew to us. But then, you know, by the time I got to college, it was so much worse. all the time I would go to, say, Wendy's and get a spicy chicken sandwich. And, you know, it's just a fried chicken patty with a bun and not really much else on it. Or say for lunch on break from work, I would go home and fire up the oven and just have the Totino's pizza rolls, which I kind of look back in horror now. I mean, not to say that these things are going to kill you and they're necessarily unhealthy. It's just, if you don't have any kind of a varied diet and you're just focusing all of your diet on processed things rather than, you know, fresh, life-giving fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and all kinds of things like that, then I think you're going to start seeing your health failing and it's going to start taking a toll. And I got my first big wake-up call when my health started doing just that. You know, it was sliding. I came back from a motorcycle ride of about maybe a couple hours or so, and I started seeing this sparkle in one of the corners of my eye, and I was thinking, like, you know, what is that? Did I just get a sunspot? You know, what's going on? And when it didn't go away, it kind of freaked me out. You know, I thought maybe I should go see the eye doctor and see what they say. So I went to the eye doctor. They put me in front of machines and had me do some tests. And then when the results came back, they actually told me, when they looked really closely, it looks like I had had a stroke in my eye. So now in my left eye, to this day, say if you look at a circle of your eye, or, you know, a circle of your vision, in my left eye on the bottom right corner, I still can't see out of that spot anymore. It's still a sparkle there, but I think my brain kind of compensates for that, and I just see clearly now. But if I really test it, I can still see that sparkle there, and I can't necessarily see out of that bottom right corner of my eye anymore, even to this day. So what do you do when you have some kind of a health crisis or something like this happens to you? I mean, at least for me, I was pretty freaked out about it. I wanted to know everything I possibly could. So the first thing I started to do was just to research anything I could on this topic, anything I could find that related to health, anything I could personally do myself. And at the same time, I took blood work and I went to the doctor to see what it could possibly be. And of course, they have like a catch-all. When they can't figure out what's going on with you, they just kind of put a generic term or a generic answer and just say, oh, you have this autoimmune disease, or you have lupus, or something like that. And, you know, there are people out there, they literally do have these kind of diseases. But if a doctor can't figure something out, at least from what I've seen, I think most of the time they just kind of dismiss it as, oh, you have an autoimmune disease and there's nothing you can do. Maybe take this pill, maybe take that pill. And I didn't want that for myself. I wanted to figure out, how can I solve this? How, you know, what's going on with my body? There's got to be some kind of reason this is going on. So at the same time I was researching this, I came across a guy named Dr. John McDougall of the McDougall Program. And just by a coincidence, since I was reading Diet for a New America, I think later on I went back and I thought, like, oh, that sounds really familiar. You go back in the book, and he's actually in the book also talking about a vegan diet, or more of what he calls a starch-based diet, with the addition of fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds, the exclusion of any kind of processed oils or animal products. And, you know, the more I got to know about, you know, what Dr. McDougall was about, the more I got excited about it. And I felt like I could really take control of my health for myself. And I still believe to this day his program can definitely change a lot of people's lives. So it's definitely worth looking into if you want to know, you know, more about how to live a healthy lifestyle, you know, away from the standard American diet. And I'll put a link to his website in the show notes. And while I was learning about all this stuff and reading about health and reading about veganism and vegetarianism, I went on vacation with my wife with her family, and we were in West Palm, Florida at some kind of a resort. And I was learning about this stuff while I was in paradise. So it's almost like your mind is in one place and your body is in a more relaxed state in this other place. But it made for almost like a revelation of sorts. And another thing that happened on that trip was I kind of opened my eyes to what real food actually tastes like. In the mornings, we would wake up, go to the kitchen, her parents would be there, and we would all start washing these fruits together, these really beautiful fruits. I remember raspberries, blueberries, fresh cherries, strawberries, and I think there was even a few more. But, I mean, just all the different flavors that you can taste when you have a platter of fresh fruit in front of you. It was just completely amazing. And, you know, I actually have to admit, though, I feel almost kind of embarrassed now, because when I tasted a fresh cherry for the first time, it was actually a big letdown. I mean, growing up, I just have this idea of a cherry tasting like a maraschino cherry. I don't think I really remember being a kid having an actual fresh cherry, probably because, you know, my parents didn't have that much money, and fresh cherries and fresh fruits of that kind, like berries and things, they were always a lot more expensive. So, you know, I didn't grow up with that experience. But then, you know, after a time of eating fresh cherries, I can look back, and if I try a maraschino cherry now, it just tastes like garbage because, you know, it's a fake, almost like a candy. And, you know, while I was in college, I think I really did finally just become so bored of food because it was the same thing over and over and over. Even if you went out and got, you know, fast food, if you ordered any number on the menu, I mean, it really didn't satisfy me. It wasn't the flavors that I was looking for, or maybe it was my body's way of saying, I'm just so bored of this. I'm not getting the nutrition that I really want. And I just wanted to find something else, you know, some kind of new thing in my life that I really crave so much. And I really just think it goes back to being human and having your body crave natural, unprocessed things. So then after this, I just continued on my journey trying to find out anything I could on health and well-being. And then in 2005, which is about, you know, a year later, me and my wife also turned vegan. And now I can say I've been vegan for about 9 years. And during that time, there's still lots of other books that I read, some of them that I'll tell you about here, but even just the ones that John Robbins wrote. So Food Revolution, that goes into more vegan ideas rather than just vegetarian. Reclaiming Our Health was more on the medical industry, and that really opened my eyes a lot on, you know, what doctors learn and things like that. May All Be Fed. Another really great, great book that I think everybody should read is Healthy at 100. In this book, Healthy at 100, I think it's a really honest look at populations around the world that live to be 100 most often. And it goes into what their lifestyle is, what they eat, what their society is like. So if you want almost like a primer on how to live to be 100 years old, this book is so great. And it's written by a vegan author, but he completely puts that to the side just to see why are they actually living to be 100. And not only 100, but healthy and 100, you know, vibrant and 100, still very active and still have very active minds and 100 years old. Very, very amazing. And other books by different authors other than John Robbins were The China Study. That was a great book by T. Colin Campbell, where researchers went into China and actually studied huge populations just to see the relationship between cancer and diet. So that's a great one to add to your list. More on the vegan idea of Slaughterhouse. It just gives you an inside look at slaughterhouses. Another one was Mad Cowboy. It was a rancher who actually questioned the way he was doing things. And this one actually ended up causing a lot of trouble for Oprah Winfrey when she had him on her show. And he actually started talking about the idea of mad cow disease and where it was coming from. So this is just a small sample of things I've read, and I even researched other things like the raw food diet, but then I just kind of concluded that wasn't for me, and it just didn't feel, you know, natural. I feel like we've evolved over thousands of years with cooking our food and, you know, also fermenting our food. So it just didn't feel like I'd gain anything more from that than I was already getting from a whole foods vegan diet. Not to say it can't be healthy, but a lot of the food in my diet was already raw, so it didn't seem like it really added anything. So I was well on my way, you know, into the vegan lifestyle and had all of this great medical knowledge and this great dietary knowledge. And I really wanted to help my dad out. He was a truck driver who ended up getting carried away with the standard American diet. He'd go to all those all-you-can-eat truck stop buffets full of, you know, fried everything. He also drank a lot of soda. And in his truck, he had those big gulps that he would always fill to the top with, you know, high fructose corn syrup soda. And he had so much of this, so much so, that for a time, his diabetes got so bad he couldn't get behind the wheel until he got it under control. I mean, I think his sugar level at one point was 600, which just seems kind of crazy. I think you can go blind at that point. Well, finally one day, I think he just knew his health was failing, and he came to me and said he was ready to change his diet and wanted to get healthier because he saw what me and my wife were doing. And I've seen so many results from people on the McDougal diet that I think it could have really worked for him, but I think it was just finally just too late. And we told him to go to the hospital, you know, just to at least get checked out for some of the pains and things he was having. And you could just tell he wasn't healthy and something was going on. But he was just so stubborn for that. You know, you would tell him to go to the hospital and he just wouldn't do it. And then, not long after, one Saturday morning, I talked to him on the phone and everything seemed fine. And then, by midday, I get a call from my mom and she's just hysterical. And I just couldn't believe it, you know, the news that you never want to hear. He was found in the driver's seat of his semi, slumped over, making a delivery. He died of heart failure at 53 years old. And that was back in 2007, so it's been 7 years. It's still almost unbelievable to think, you know, my dad isn't there anymore. And out of everything he had ever done in his life, it being a crew chief on a UH-1H helicopter in Vietnam, working in an iron ore mine a half a mile underground, he had scuba dived the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, and even all of the odd jobs and the construction jobs that he had in his life, it's just crazy to believe that in the end, it was his diet that killed him at only 53 years old. I don't want that for myself, and I don't want that for any of you. You should never be complacent when it comes to considering all aspects of health and learning something new that could lead you to a new understanding in your life. You always owe it to yourself and your family to keep on learning. So that's kind of a background of everything that kind of brought me into the vegan lifestyle and why I still continue it today. All right, so now that I've gone over some of the background, let me go over some arguments for being vegan and then some arguments against being vegan. And then I'll come back and give you some of the conclusions I've had over the past 9 or 10 years on this topic. So to start with, let's go over some of the arguments for being vegan and why you should go vegan. You get more vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds, which are plants, which also means you get more fiber. You don't get any cancer-causing meats. You don't get any cancer-causing dairy products like milk, cheese, butter, etc. And you also get less accumulated toxins from bioaccumulation. And this is what happens when animals have toxins in their diet. They just keep on accumulating as they eat more and more, and they just keep accumulating in their fat. So all of these toxins deposit into their fat stores. In the ethical area, you're not directly killing animals. You're also not supporting a system that is abusing animals, so factory farming. So say when dairy cows are kept, they're only kept for the milk, and then when they finally have babies, the babies are taken from them and then confined for their really short lives. And to make veal, which is a really tender, young kind of meat, they take those baby calves and don't let them move around and feed them a diet that keeps their meat very tender, which is one of the cruelest practices you could probably do. So I don't think a lot of people realize what they're supporting when they eat veal. Chickens are normally kept by the hundreds or the thousands in large factory farms where they stack them and close the light out so they never actually get to see light of day. They never even get to step on grass and forage like they normally would. And then pigs end up being confined more like in crates to where they can't turn around. So those are just, you know, some of the arguments for some of the animals that are involved in this. In the area of sustainability and the environment, some of the traditional arguments, like one I've heard from John Robbins a lot, would be cycling grain that you could normally eat through animals instead. And normally the ratio we hear is it takes 16 pounds of grain to equal 1 pound of meat. And why wouldn't humans just eat the grain first instead of cycling it through an animal? Another one would be grazing of animals leads to degradation of land and soil. And another one would be animals produce large amounts of methane and create pollution. And there are several other arguments as to why you should go vegan, but these are just a handful of them. So now for the arguments against being vegan and, you know, why you should never go vegan, why you should never consider it. And some of these include plants don't have enough protein, or a plant's protein is incomplete, so they don't have all the necessary amino acids to make a complete protein, whereas meat does. Another one is there's no natural form of B12 in a vegan's diet, or you don't get enough vitamin D, you know, like the amount you get in milk on a vegan's diet. There's also never been a culture in history that has ever lived on a purely vegan diet. And also, you end up getting more grains in your diet, which we're not meant to eat grains. So those are just a few of the arguments why you should never be vegan. So just some of my conclusions after, you know, about 10 years on the subject, I can blow a lot of these arguments out of the water on either side, whether it's for or against. So let's just start with for being vegan, why you should go vegan. You get more vegetables, fruits, nuts, and seeds, which means you get more fiber. Because if you start taking things out of your diet, so say like meat, dairy products, eggs, you're most likely going to replace it with some form of plant. And the more plants that you get, more likely the more fiber that you're going to get. because all fiber comes from plants. No fiber comes from any kind of meat product or dairy product or egg product. The next one is you don't get cancer-causing meats, which I think is mostly true if you're talking about factory farm meats, and especially if you're not replacing it with cancer-causing soy garbage products, like a lot of those fake hamburger patties and fake hot dogs and things like that. And the same thing goes for the argument of the replacing milk, cheese, butter, and eggs. If you start replacing these with the vegan alternatives that are just garbage, you know, filled with chemicals and soy protein isolate and crap like that, then it's no better than just eating the original thing. And when I'm talking about all of these animal products, I'm not talking about the traditional family farmed local products that you would think of, you know, your grandparents making on their small family farm. I'm talking about just the manufactured large factory farming. Now the next one, less accumulated toxins from bioaccumulation. This is mostly true in the case that animals do bioaccumulate toxins and heavy metals in their fat. This is why you're always warned against eating tuna, because tuna is a very large fish, and they eat small fish, who then eat small fish, who then eat smaller fish, and then it just accumulates toxins up the food chain in its fat. And then into the ethical side of the arguments where you're not directly killing animals. This is part true and part untrue. I'll cover this later when I talk about if someone can truly be vegan. The next one on going vegan is you're not supporting a system that is abusing animals when it comes to factory farming. That's, you know, completely true because you're not supporting a system like that. On the argument about cycling grain through animals, you know, the 16 pounds of grain to the 1 pound of meat, this is actually true in the sense that feeding grain to animals only to produce meat is a wasteful practice, and it really only makes those animals sick because they're not necessarily designed to handle just grains. They're designed more for grasses. And the only reason they do this is because they get the grain cheap and it's only used to fatten the animals up quickly. And the problem with this is, you know, say you have GMO seeds or GMO grain, that's being heavily sprayed with different toxins. You know, the same thing, you're going to bioaccumulate all those toxins in that animal's fat. Instead of using grains, you can actually harness the natural function of that grazing animal. You know, the kind you would traditionally find on like a large plain. So think of like a buffalo that would normally be grazing in, you know, large mobs, moving from one place to the next. And that's what actually kept the prairies healthy. And that was a, you know, more of a natural function for a grazing animal. But of course, you know, history showed that barbed wire put a stop to that. The next one on for being vegan is grazing of animals leads to the degradation of land and soil. And this actually used to be true and still is on the majority when it comes to today's farming practices, but this is actually starting to be challenged more and more now by people like Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms or Alan Savory, who have actually used animals' natural function of grazing to repair soil faster than it normally could have. And I'll put a link in the show notes to a really great TED talk by Alan Savory, who actually shows he's healed land in Africa just using animals. And the final one I'll bring up on for being vegan is animals produce large amounts of methane and create pollution. And this is also historically true in the majority, but if you could somehow harness that methane that's produced through fermentation from the cow's manure, I'll put a link in the show notes. Jeff Lawton has a great video out now that shows you how you can take the manure from 3 dairy cows and you can provide yourself with enough cooking gas for a house of 6 people using a biogas digester. So it's the same kind of idea, you know, like what I was talking about in permaculture. If you see a problem, that problem could be a solution to something else. So a lot of these traditional arguments now for being vegan are kind of falling by the wayside as we start to take nutrients and pollution and redirect it into a positive direction. All right, so now some of my thoughts on, you know, the arguments against being vegan or why you should never go vegan. So the first one, plants don't have enough protein or where do you get your protein? And this one is largely overblown. All you have to do is think about some of the largest animals on the planet and realize they only eat plants. So imagine elephants, giraffes, horses, hippos, cows, and back in the dinosaurs age, some of the largest dinosaurs on Earth only ate plants. And yes, you know, some of them have different digestive systems and all that, but we also digest plants, and we don't only get our protein from just plants. Plants have plenty of protein. This has largely been way overblown, and Dr. John McDougall has a great article on this that I'll post in the show notes. The next one is plants don't have complete protein. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Dr. McDougall has argued this point over and over and over. Plants don't have as much protein as meat does, but it is complete. They possess all of the amino acids necessary to make a complete protein, and our body breaks those down and reassembles them to create the proteins that we need. I mean, if this wasn't true, you know, I wouldn't still be here. And the other thing is people need much less protein than what we're told. Even Arnold Schwarzenegger had said this. So if you consider at a time in our lives when we have the most rapid development, so say the first 2 years of our life, we're doubling in size. Our ideal food is human breast milk, which is 5% protein. Now compare this to when we're adults, when we're not doubling in size. We need much, much less than 5% protein. We need way less than what we keep being told that we need. And if you doubt the protein in plants, let's just run through the protein content of a few different plants and see if it would actually be enough to supply all the protein we need when we're doubling in size. So let's just look at rice. It's 8% protein. Corn is 11% protein. Oats are 15% protein, and beans are 27% protein. So protein deficiency when eating whole plant foods is not possible. It can't be done if you're eating enough calories on a plant-based diet. It just can't be done. Whole populations of people like in rural Poland and Russia have lived on single plant sources of protein like potatoes with hard work and are just fine. So think of South Americans where they eat mostly potatoes. The next argument is there's no natural form of B12 in a vegan's diet. When you think of B12, B12 doesn't come from meat or dairy. It actually comes from a bacteria. And really, I think this is more of a sanitation or a sterilization of everything in our life and not being more connected to the natural world the way we used to be. So back then, you know, produce from the garden wasn't extremely sterilized the way it is today where everything is killed off. Even our water supply wasn't traditionally sterile. It either came from the river or a well. And now people today are just scared of every little bacteria. So whenever we get food from the store, it's either irradiated, washed with chlorine water, or just sanitized with other chemicals and everything is killed. And you know, today this is good and bad. We have a higher quality of living, but the trade-off now is you don't get that natural B12 producing bacteria unless you supplement it. And it's not actually hard to supplement it because it seems like every fortified food has B12 in it. And I've heard you can have up to a 20-year supply of B12 in your body. So that goes a long way. You know, even if you have a little bit every day or a little bit, you know, here and there, it's going to add up. And with a 20-year supply in your body, it's not a big deal because you're going to be getting it from here and there. You know, unless you're one of those people that have that genetic flaw where it just doesn't let you get enough, then, you know, you have to think about supplementation. So the next one is you don't get enough vitamin D on a vegan diet, you know, the same amount as you would get in milk. And I have to call BS on this one because milk is artificially fortified with vitamin D. That's the only reason you think of cow's milk is so high in vitamin D is because it's artificially fortified and it's highly advertised that way. Vitamin D actually comes from the sun. It's produced by a hormone in our body that turns sunlight into vitamin D, and all you need is as little as, you know, 15 minutes of sunlight on your skin every day, and that's pretty much all you need. So the history on this one is when people migrated north, our skin started becoming lighter and lighter, so we had the ability to absorb more sunlight with, you know, less and less light. Which is why people in Africa have such darker skin colors, you know, approaching dark brown to black, because they were getting so much sun, they didn't need that much. And if you're in a northern climate that gets much less sunlight, traditionally this was a problem, which is why, you know, in the north, supplementation came from foods like fatty fish and salmon and tuna and other things like liver, cheese, egg yolks, and mushrooms. So really, vitamin D has nothing to do with a vegan diet. It has everything to do with how much sun you get and how much you can actually absorb the sun due to your skin color. The next argument is there's never been a culture in history that's lived on a purely vegan diet. And of course this is actually true, but I think that's changing and one day we'll have a lot more data on that and that'll be very interesting. But if you want to read, you know, more on that subject, just read Healthy at 100 by John Robbins. The final argument against veganism is that you get more grains in your diet and we're not meant to eat grains. You know, our body can't handle grains, it can't do it. And this is also not true. I mean, we can actually handle grains. We have an enzyme in our saliva called amylase that begins the process of breaking down starch into maltose, which is the predecessor of glucose. And archaeologists have also shown that ancient people had this enzyme present in their saliva. So no matter what argument you hear saying we're not meant to digest grains, we're biologically built to be able to digest starch and break it down into sugar. So the process goes like this. You chew up a piece of food or a starch, you know, a grain. Saliva releases in your mouth, including the amylase enzyme. It mixes with your food and begins breaking the starch down into maltose. Once that partially broken down starch hits your stomach, the strong gastric juices there stop this process. So starch actually isn't broken down in your stomach. It actually pauses there. And then once it gets to your small intestine, your pancreas secretes pancreatic juice, which contains pancreatic amylase, which then breaks down whatever starch was missed into maltose. And then in the final step, another enzyme called maltase breaks the maltose down into glucose, which then enters your bloodstream. And you can actually start the breakdown of starch and grains by sprouting them or malting them, like you'd be more familiar with in the beer making industry. This starts the process of breaking down the starch into sugars, but there's actually another way of doing this that traditional people used to do. Maize or corn would be ground into flour, dried, and then people would actually chew a ball of flour and press it to the roof of their mouth. The cakes would then be laid out to dry, and what they were doing is actually using the amylase in their saliva to start the process of breaking the starch in the grain into sugars to make their alcoholic beverage called chicha. So even traditionally, we understood that we're able to digest grains. Now, I will, though, support that grains are different from ancient grains that we used to have. I mean, nowadays, the wheat gluten is just highly available in different grains. I mean, much more so than it used to be. And now in grains, we even have genetically modified things, like genetically modified corn, which is just crazy. You know, we never had back then. And the other thing I will support, though, that if you're eating a lot more grains, it also means you're probably getting a lot more herbicides if you're not eating organic grains. Now, the next idea I want to talk about, occasionally I'll even get the question, can anyone truly be vegan? And on the surface, this sounds like an easy, straightforward, simple question, but can anyone truly be vegan? And at first thought, you know, you just want to say yes, but if you really think about this, if you really want to dig into this and actually answer the question, it really just comes down to one simple thing, one question you can ask yourself, and that is, what do you define vegan as? What is vegan to you? If it's not eating animals directly, then pretty much, yes, you can be vegan. If your definition is more not killing animals in the production of your vegetarian food, like grains, then no, it's actually not possible. And this is because in the harvesting and processing of plant sources, animals that habitat that environment, you know, and that food, when that food is harvested, in the end, they end up being killed also. And, you know, this includes mice, rabbits, birds, animals like that. Now, if you take it one step farther and in your definition you include insects and byproducts like animal hair, then that's even more not possible. And for the same reason, you know, because of harvesting and processing. And one great example of this is imagine peanut butter, just this one product. The FDA has confirmed that per 100 grams of processed peanut butter, you can expect an average of 30 or more insect fragments and an average of one or more rodent hairs. So even in just manufactured processing that has standards, you still can't expect to truly be vegan. And some people even include not eating honey in their definition of being vegan, but I just find this kind of ridiculous. I mean, I think you can be a beekeeper and harvest surplus honey as long as you're following sustainable practices and leaving them what they require in honey, you know, to get them through the winter. But leaving them sugar water or high fructose corn syrup, I just find that totally outrageous. Also, I think if you're a beekeeper, it's your responsibility as a beekeeper to make sure you plant a wide variety of perennial flowers that they can source their nectar from. And some people say you're just using the bees, but I think it's more of a question of sustainability and, you know, what are you giving back to them in return for their honey? You can't just be a taker in this deal. You have to provide value for value. And that value is creating the environment of, you know, varied flora, the flowers that they require of you. Just as if you were to harvest your vegetables or your fruits from the earth, you have to give back. You have to give back nutrition, give back the nutrients that you took from that area. Otherwise, the next crop won't be as nutritious, or the next plants that are coming up in succession won't have the right amount of nutrients to grow. And finally, on your definition of what vegan is, if you decide to include bacteria or microorganisms in this definition, you need a slap in the face, because it's definitely not possible and absolutely ridiculous. We're made up more of bacteria than we are of us, and we need them. We die without their functions. They break down food for us with fermentation, and we supply them with that food. So in the end, you can drive yourself crazy with what is and what isn't vegan, but the real question you need to ask yourself, even more than what is vegan, the real question you're actually trying to arrive at is, what is sustainable? And I think this just goes back to permaculture's three ethics: care of the earth, care of people, return of surplus, back to the first two ethics. If in the end, if you're ethically producing more than you're consuming according to permaculture's three ethics, then that is sustainable and veganism is irrelevant. That's not to say you're not making a difference being vegan. I just think that with permaculture, you're making more of a difference in the world that we actually live in now than just by blindly going vegan and not considering all the aspects of what's behind that decision. So I think if you want a good idea of kind of what I'm talking about, I have a comparison of being vegan to the organic label, which the organic label I think is losing favor rapidly, and I think it should just be replaced with permaculture, but organic is just a government thing. So in any case, being vegan and the organic label, both can be good and both can be bad. So on the vegan side, there are vegans who follow a varied whole foods, nutritious diet full of colorful, fresh produce. But then again, you know, there are Oreo and Dorito eating, soda drinking vegans whose health is failing just as bad as those in the standard American diet. And on the organic label side, there's organic produce that doesn't have the herbicides and pesticides, and they follow sustainable practices like the ones I talk about in permaculture. But then there's organic produce that's just lacking in nutrients. You know, they're no better than standard produce, and they absolutely ravage the soil quality and soil health with unsustainable practices. And I think, you know, eventually companies like Walmart and Monsanto, they're going to try to figure out how to get GMOs into the organic label. So as far as I'm concerned, the organic label means almost nothing to me nowadays, and I relate that to the vegan label only because if you're not taking into account how your food is produced, it can be just as bad or worse for the environment than factory farming. Closing out what I think about different eating styles, you can actually be healthy on many different diets, but I think the more you start moving toward a plant-based diet or just getting more plants and fruits and nuts and seeds into your diet, I think the more healthy that actually is. So whether you're on a diet that's like the McDougal plan, that's based on starches, vegetables, nuts and seeds, and the exclusion of meat, dairy products, and oils, or you're on the paleo diet of hunter-gatherer, or the Mediterranean diet that consists of fresh produce and fats, and probably even several other types of diets, I think the real question comes down to moderation. And I think most people probably can't handle moderation, which is why some of these diets are probably better for somebody that's more of like type A and they're going to go to the extreme of anything. And, you know, we've all heard of someone who's lived on the standard American diet all their life, you know, smoking cigars, drinking whiskey, and then they live to be 100. But all I can say on that is don't count on it. And a lot of time, those kind of people have lived that long, but the quality of their life isn't as great as what it could have been. It's also possible if they had a higher quality of diet, imagine either how much longer or how much better they could have felt at their old age. So again, in the end, I think it just comes down to moderation. Another question I commonly get is, you know, what in the world do you eat? You know, what do you eat on a regular basis? You know, what did you have for breakfast this morning? And just to give a broad answer, I eat pretty much everything. I eat all ethnic cuisines, Italian, Mexican, Indian, Thai, Japanese, Vietnamese, and even American. So basically every type of cuisine is there. So say on Mexican, I would have bean burritos or tacos or Mexican rice, guacamole, salsa, hot sauce, you know, just leave the cheese or sour cream off. Under Italian, there's bread, soups like minestrone and salads, pasta with marinara. Under Indian, there's a lot of things like rice and beans, vegetable masalas, lentil dishes, soups like mulligatawny, chutneys like onion or mango, those flat pancakes that are made of lentils called dosas. Under Thai, there's noodles like pad thai. There's really good creamy vegetable coconut curries with rice or noodles. And even in American, like I was saying, you can have veggie burgers. You can home make them with rice, beans, and vegetables. You know, there's mashed potatoes and gravy. There's even barbecue. And you can have some of those fake hot dogs. Like, tofurkey sausages isn't that bad, but I would definitely say don't have a lot of that fake stuff all the time. It's just, most of it is just garbage. And you're trying to replace this stuff for a reason. You're trying to get back to more natural, whole things. So just to close all this out, can you be vegan and involved in fermentation? And the only reason I go through all this background and health aspects and defining what vegan is because you should consider all these aspects when you're thinking about being vegan and whether or not you can ferment. I mean, human beings are survivors, and at some point we realized we could harness fermentation to further our species by making food last longer than it would have. We also realized we could introduce so many different flavors into our diet, and culturally fermented foods make up and round out every aspect of our diet. To not partake in fermented foods at all, whether you're vegan, paleo, or whatever, isn't partaking in the human experience. We've co-evolved inside and out with so many different cultures and strains of microorganisms, it doesn't matter whether or not you want to be part of fermentation. You are fermentation. Your digestive system is fermentation. So whatever kind of food you decide to feed yourself, you're going to be part of fermentation whether you like it or not. You might as well give in and help these little guys along by nurturing them and stop being so afraid of bacteria and completely sterilizing everything in your life. So in the end, embrace it, learn from it, enjoy all the natural wonders and flavors that fermentation can offer, whether you're vegan or not. This has been Paul Bates, encouraging you to change your life, ferment responsibly, and get out there and create some culture.